Linoleum Knife.
Yay!
Coming to you from beautiful Park City, Utah, once again, Alonzo Duraldi, film critic, film reviews editor for The Wrap and film critic for What the Flick. Once again, Dave White has opted not to join me at the beautiful Sundance Film Festival. So he did the B-Movies podcast this week with Whitney Seibold. And I am lucky enough to have with me once again this year to talk about the stuff we've seen at Sundance, William Bibbs Bibbiani of the B-Movies podcast.
Yes, the B-Movies podcast. You can read my reviews and interviews from Sundance at Crave Online. And I also write for Blumhouse and Coming Soon and a bunch of other stuff.
Yes.
I forget to plug my stuff sometimes, so I wanted to get out of the way now. All right. And now there'll be no more self-serving stuff.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
It is Sunday evening. The sun is setting. So the first weekend of the festival is pretty much done. There have already been a lot of high-profile acquisitions. This is turning into one of those years where people are actually spending money again, which... history seems to indicate it's not always a great idea.
Often it's a very bad idea, but this year it's a little different because a lot of people who are buying stuff are newer entities,
sure,
like Netflix movies, Amazon Studios, and they have other avenues to make money, so they don't even really care. They just want to look good.
Sure. I mean, it might be just like a lost leader for them to be able to show, like, hey, we're players, you know.
Exactly. One Oscar nomination and they win.
So somebody, you know? Exactly. Somebody was telling me today, in fact, who has worked for different production entities, that a lot of times companies will come up here and they feel like they have to buy something,
yeah,
to justify all the money they spent to get here in the first place. Because, you know, Sundance isn't cheap. You have to fly to Utah. You're staying at a ski resort. So it's not like it's easy to find cheap hotel rooms.
Yeah.
The food is all resort priced. So, you know, if you
we better spend $5 million on Happy Texas. Otherwise.
Yeah. What was the point?
Yeah. That was a mistake.
So yeah, so we'll see where that all winds up. But anyway, the business side is not our bailiwick. So things got rolling Thursday night. I really was excited about seeing other people, and unfortunately my plan landed late, and so I was not able to get to the press office in time to get my ticket, but you went.
I did.
Tell us about what that is.
Yeah, that was the second movie I saw at Sundance. This is a movie from Chris Kelly, the writer-director. I believe he's worked at Saturday Night Live.
And Broad City also, I think.
Yeah, and this is his big feature debut, apparently. And it is the story of a gay television writer. And he went up and introduced the film, and I'm just like, yeah, okay, got it. True story. Gay television writer. Who moves back in with his parents when his mom is diagnosed with terminal cancer. And spends the next year of his life, it's basically the worst year of his life, mm-hmm, for a variety of reasons. On one hand, his mom is dying, which sucks. On the other hand, he's stuck in the house with a dad who loves him but has never quite forgiven him for the whole gay thing. And his career is going nowhere. He can't date anyone because he's in Sacramento, and apparently it's like a demilitarized zone of homosexuality. It's kind of this lovely cornucopia of Sundance cliches that all just sort of congeal together. And it's not bad, actually, because a lot of those stories are stories we see over and over again for a reason. They're universal. They
sure
mean something. All that really matters is that they come from a new, fresh voice, and that we see a different perspective on it, and other people gives you that. But I don't know. It's a tricky thing, because on one hand, the cast is really great. Jesse Plemons, a.k.a. Meth Damon, a.k.a. Fat Damon, he plays the protagonist, and he's lovable, and Molly Shannon is fantastic as the dying mom. She made me cry, like specifically her, not even the movie. She's just really good. But at the same time, well, I laughed because it's actually very funny,
mm-hmm,
and I cried because it was actually very sad. And I have to admit, say that makes it a good movie. I don't know who I can recommend this to. It's like, hey, you want to relive the slow death of your parents? Do you want to do that for about like an hour and a half? Well, I've got the movie for you.
Well, you know, people can find that kind of thing cathartic in movies. I mean, like, you know, in terms of endearment, I think if you could describe it in a way that makes it sound unwatchable.
But it's not all just the death in terms of endearment. That's just one part of it. There's a lot of silly stuff, like the whole thing with Jack Nicholson and Shirley MacLaine is very funny. And there's elements of that here, and there are some side quests that he goes on. There's this one, he has one other gay friend in Sacramento who doesn't live there but visits a lot because he has a little brother there. The little brother is like just this Lady Gaga boy who's like just he feels like he came from another movie, like a jokier, sillier movie.
Mm-hmm.
But they make the point that, you know, this is a new generation and we're all going to wish we were this confidently gay.
You know, it's funny that you bring up generations because I attended a panel yesterday about the sort of the new queer cinema, or sort of the current faces of queer cinema, that was moderated by B. Ruby Rich, who's been on the show, and she's a legendary film critic and scholar, and she coined the term the new queer cinema at Sundance in 1992.
Okay.
Because, you know, 91 was the year that Poison and Paris is Burning won the two grand jury prizes.
Right, right.
And so then in 92, she had this big panel that was like Derek Jarman and Todd Haynes and Sadie Benning. And
so this is the new queer cinema that we're in now.
Yes.
And then there'll be the new.
We're probably at new at this point, but anyway.
Okay.
In any event, you know, so having Ruby at Sundance doing a panel with queer directors has a lineage to it and has a sense of historical, you know, context and place. So at the end, when they opened up for questions, I raised my hand and I asked the filmmakers, one of whom was Chris Kelly, what do you guys feel about, you know, sort of the pantheon of queer filmmakers? Do you feel like you're part of it? Do you feel influenced by those directors from the early 90s who really kind of broke out with this stuff at Sundance, that, you know, trying to kind of put this into sort of a historical context?
Mm-hmm.
Crickets.
Well, had they heard of anybody?
I don't know. It was
like, there's a couple. Like, you have some easy answers. Yeah, like, I could fake that.
Sure,
like,
they knew. I mean, Todd Haynes, like, had been mentioned, you know, at some point in the conversation.
Go back further. Kenneth Anger, John Waters. Just throw out a name.
They weren't completely ignorant, but it was like, but, you know, in the course of the discussion, they had all cited people like, you know, Ozu and Bergman and Soderbergh as influences and stuff. You know, I mean, Clea DuVall was on this panel. She's part of the new queer cinema, whether she likes it or not. You know, I mean, at least the second wave of it with But I'm a Cheerleader. So it was just really, and I felt A, suddenly super old, and B, you know, I'm about to start teaching a class on gay and lesbian cinema, and I was like, okay, so does this generation just not care at all?
They might not know. There's actually, I'm going to segue, I don't want to hijack the show, but I'm gonna, there's a, that reminds me of, there's a scene in Wiener Dog, the new Todd Solondz movie that's playing here at Sundance. Which I'll go into a bit more depth, but it's a film that's an anthology of shorts from Todd Solondz that are all sort of loosely connected by the presence of a wiener dog who changes owners multiple times over the course of the film. And in my favorite segment, this is a really great short story even on its own, Danny DeVito plays a film professor who had like one hit, like one hit screenplay, and has since floundered and he hates his life. And you can tell, because Todd Solondz also teaches cinema, how much he hates his students sometimes. Because there's a lot of stuff in there. This guy's just like, hey, listen, start with a story. Start with a what if, and then ask what happens afterwards. And I'm like, no, but I really want to start, you know, I really want to wrap it around this sort of dynamic of this essay I read in Collier's or whatever, some stupid nonsense. But there's this bit where they're having an interview for people to go into the film school. Something I had to do once. And they were just like, okay, so what are some filmmakers that influence you? And this preppy kid says, oh, you know, there's so many. There's just so many. I don't even know if I can pick one. Okay, well, what did you see in the last couple of years that you really, really liked? Oh, I know this. There's so many. I can't even pick. I've just seen so many. In the last week, oh, you know, name a movie. Name one movie. And he can't do it. And I died laughing. That short is fantastic. Do you want to just talk about the rest of the
episode? Let's talk about Wiener Dog.
Okay, right? And then I'll let you do one. I feel bad. So Wiener Dog is a film. So Todd Solondz is like, what is it, like America's pornography of misery merchant? He's a misery pornographer. And and oftentimes his films, I have to say, they're really good, but I also never want to see them again. Like Dark Horse. You were with me when I saw Dark Horse. It depressed the hell out of me.
Yeah, Dave makes the case that Solondz is compassionate to his characters, or is at least sort of unflinching about revealing them, and that sometimes that translates into people thinking that he's being condescending. I tend to think he's being condescending more often than not, but not always.
I don't think he's being condescending. I think he's sadistic. I think that there is, oftentimes when we think about characters who have to deal with the whims of fate and are constantly being screwed, you look at everything from, I know, Martin Scorsese's After Hours to Sam Raimi's Evil Dead 2. It's just about these, how bad can these people's lives get?
Or Drag Me to Hell.
Or Drag Me to Hell, but whatever. But we think of it as fate, but really it's the filmmaker. The filmmaker's sure, yeah. like, how much can I torture this
How many pins can I put in this butterfly?
And Todd Solondz looks at the entire scope of human existence, and he chooses only to film the depressing parts most of the time. Mm. And there's value to that, and that's certainly something I admire, the confrontational parts of his movies, but I don't want to watch them most of the time. Sure. And when I saw that Todd Solondz was doing a movie called Wiener Dog, about a wiener dog, my first thought was, we'd better not get too attached to that dog. Because there's no way. I'm not going to tell you, but suffice it to say,
if there's any filmmaker you can't trust not to kill the dog.
Yeah, I'm not going to say whether or not the dog dies, but some unpleasant things happen to the dog. And if you have, if you're one of those people who, like, you'd rather know if something bad happens to a dog and spoil the movie's twist ending than anything, all I'll say is maybe you don't want to see Wiener Dog. But that really isn't a spoiler. Just bad things happen. Anyway, so it's four stories. First one is about this kid who's just recovering from cancer, and his parents, played by Tracy Letts and Julie Delpy, decide to get him a dog. Okay, you know, he'll learn responsibility. It'll be nice. And then they are so obsessed with their lives and the way things are that they can't make room for this dog. Everything the dog does is just destroying their sanity. And then they start making up more and more elaborate lies about dogs and dog health and everything in order to sort of justify it, to make, try to make sure the kid doesn't really care if the dog lives or dies.
Oh,
and it's really, really depressing. And then it, the dog, I'm not going to tell you how, the dog changes hands and ends up in the hands of Don Wiener from Welcome to the Dollhouse, now played not by Heather Matarazzo, but by Greta Gerwig.
Okay.
Who I like as an actress, but man, that's a shift. That's a really dramatic, that's like some I'm Not There kind of stuff right there. Like, that's a major, like, all of a sudden Bob Dylan's Cate Blanchett. What's going on, huh? And she actually reunites with, like, that bully kid she had, like, almost had, like, a romance with in Welcome to the Dollhouse. Now he's played by Karen Culkin. And that one, all I'll say is that that one is the least depressing out of all of them, and it almost feels like it's sweet and that there might be some hope for them by the end of it. But then you remember that in Palindromes, we found out that she killed herself. So a part of me wonders if this is a retcon and Todd Solondz feels bad about that. Not bad enough to cast Heather Matarazzo again, but I don't know. Or maybe it's not canon. I have no idea. And then we go to the Danny DeVito bit, and then there's this really wonderful final bit with Ellen Burstyn as this old woman who names the dog Cancer. The dog has some really unfortunate names. And in a very, like, in just two scenes, you learn so much about her character. It's like a really excellent piece of writing. It's really interesting. Like, she has, like, a granddaughter who comes to visit, and then she goes out in the backyard, and that's it. And it's a great short film.
Huh.
It's really, really awesome. So it's as with a lot of anthologies, it's a little hit or miss. I think some of them will rub you wrong. Some of them might feel a little bit like, did that even need a wiener dog? Like, you kind of just threw that in.
It's Dachshund Jotem.
Yeah, basically. But it's quite good, and I would recommend you see it, as provided that you don't mind unpleasant things may or may not happen to a dog.
Well, it's funny when you mention, you know, filmmakers that dwell on the unpleasant aspects of life. I always think about, have you ever been in those hostile Q&As where somebody in the audience goes, well, why don't you just film somebody taking a dump or something, you know?
We've seen two of those.
I was going to say, which was my segue.
I've seen two of those. You saw one.
My segment is Cemetery of Splendor, the new film from Abhichapong Virasethakul, which Dave White is very excited to see.
I love how fast you say his name. You're so proud you know how to pronounce that.
It took a long time. Dave's a huge fan of Mr. Virasethakul's films. I did love Uncle Boonmi. I'm less of a fan of Syndromes and A Century, and those are the only ones I've seen.
And I've actually, this is my first of his films. I've heard wonderful things about Uncle Boonmi, obviously, and I do intend to get to it at some point, but it never became a priority, and now I wish I had, because it's my understanding that everyone loves that movie, and everyone left the theater of this one kind of scratching their heads.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, you know, we just had the episode with Manola Dargis as one of our guests, and one of the things she said was, you know, it's okay if I don't always understand a movie. There are other things I can get out of it, and it doesn't necessarily have to be that I completely walk out of it completely understanding it. And then maybe I'll catch up with it later, maybe I won't.
That's fair.
And with his films, I give him a huge benefit of the doubt in that I think there's a lot of sort of specifically Thai kind of mysticism going on. Mm-hmm. There's a lot about reincarnation and past lives and resurgences and repetitions.
And also just contemporary cultural stuff about the army and so on that I'm sure if I were more immersed in the culture would mean a little more.
Exactly, yeah. So I'm kind of like, all right, I'll take that as read and fine, we'll move on. So you have this schoolhouse that has been converted into a hospital for soldiers who are returning from a war?
I think so. Something
happened to them.
Like
and
a
now,
proper battle or something.
Yeah, and now they sleep all the time. Mm-hmm. And so this is a movie about people sleeping, so it's hard not to join them at times.
I had that moment where your head goes down like, hey.
I felt like I was interacting, you know. Because, to the point where, some of them are having nightmares, so they all get CPAP machines, and they get these white columns that sort of start glowing kind of red and blue and green colors as kind of this sort of soothing thing.
It's like a really lazy rave, just,
very slow. And then later, there are these static shots of the streets around the hospital or places where some of the characters have been, and those same colors slowly kind of, imbue the whole screen. There's a woman who has a severe limp. She has one leg is shorter than the other one.
By several inches, like half a foot.
Yeah. I think she says it's 10 centimeters. Mm-hmm. And so she starts visiting because that was her school back in the day, and the nurses there were some of her classmates. And she becomes attached to this one sleeping soldier who has no family, and she kind of sort of takes him on as a project, and occasionally he wakes up and they go and they eat or they go to a movie, but then he'll fall back asleep and they gotta haul him back to the hospital until the next time he wakes up.
Yeah.
And she's married to an American
who's really not in the movie that much.
Not much. It's
kind of an incidental thing.
And then eventually there's a psychic in the hospital who sort of tells the loved ones of the sleeping soldiers what they're dreaming about, what they're thinking about, and what they want to eat. And then the woman with the limp meets the two goddesses from the shrine that she goes to, who manifest themselves to her and tell her that the reason that the soldiers are sleeping is because the school was built on the burial ground of kings, and now the soldiers are helping the kings in the dream dimension.
Yeah, they're fighting the wars of the kings in a dream dimension, and I'm like, I want to see that. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of description of what's going on in the dream dimension. There's a tour of a castle that's no longer there, and there's kind of pointing things, and you were saying, well, that's cheap.
There's this thing that they do where, someone's like, oh yeah, well, I can show you around. Here, take a look. This is the most opulent room in the entire palace, and all we see is them walking around the park. And it's this lazy mime. I'll just tell you what I'm miming. It's really impressive. Trust me, I haven't figured out how to mime it yet, but it's really good. On one hand, that's kind of beautiful because you think about how you use your imagination. But at the same time, I'm really detached from it. I can't quite get into this movie.
Well, but then by the end of it, some of this might have been a dream. All of it might have been a dream. Mm-hmm.
It's one of those.
It's one of those.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful. It's beautifully shot, and the compositions are gorgeous. He will leave his camera and just lock that puppy down, but he'll give you things to look at in the frame. And did you notice in the moment where they're sitting at that outdoor, at the where all the sort of food stalls are and they're having dinner, the people walking by, some of them were like, hey, there's a camera.
No, I missed that. That's funny.
Not super obviously, but there's this really long take. The two, the woman and the soldier are talking, and I, every so often over their shoulder, I would see somebody kind of register that there was a camera and then kind of keep going.
That's funny.
But yeah, it's a cool movie.
I was thinking, you mentioned the thing Manolo Dargis said when we saw the screening. And I've been thinking about it. I don't need to understand it. And I don't need to understand it, but that's not the only criteria. And I'm a little worried that if we focus too much on that comment, we might start giving movies a pass just for being enigmatic.
Well, sure.
And I'm not saying you're doing that, obviously, but I just want to make it clear that it's okay to dislike something and not get it. And I would never say it's bad. It just, there was no in. Mm. This movie that we made within a culture that never invites me into the culture, it never explains anything, and it's not its responsibility to do so. Sure. I'm not faulting the film. But I didn't know what to make of it, and so I'm just sort of going, huh, well, that's probably quite good. I can't review it. No, I can't review it on the site because I have no idea what to say.
Sure.
It's a weird experience.
And I mean, there's a fine line there. It's sort of like, I think, the way that Dave loved The Assassin way more than I did.
Yeah.
It's a movie that I admire, but it doesn't sort of directly speak to me or directly engage me in a way that makes me more excited about it. And so this is sort of the same with this one. I can tell you what it does right and what's beautiful about it and what's well constructed about it.
Mm-hmm.
But then thematically or narratively, I'm at a loss. I have no idea.
I'm kind of the same way about the film I saw just before Cemetery Splendor, which is the other poop movie.
Ah.
This movie is called Wild. It's a German film.
Yes.
Don't read too much. Well, okay, fine. Anyway, it's about a woman who, on her walking to work, walks through a park every day.
Mm-hmm.
One day, she sees a wolf. Big old wolf in the park. Look at that wolf. Huh. And then she starts looking up wolves on the internet. Starts getting more and more interested in wolves. She has a very boring social life. She has a very boring job. Her boss is a jerk. And then she starts looking up how to capture wolves. How to take care of wolves. And she, for like about half the film, she's organizing a way to capture this wolf and put it into like her sister's apartment, which she's subletting. And she does, and we realize as she has this wolf in a bedroom and she's putting on like a motorcycle helmet and pads to feed it raw steak, that she's really got the hots for this wolf. Like, she really, really, really wants to do sex to this wolf. And the movie doesn't quite go there. It goes like halfway there, and that's enough. Mm. And a part of me was like very interested in this film because, wow, okay, we're going to go there. We're just going to explore this because the history of sort of sexual attraction and the sexual interpretations of animals goes really far back. You could totally make something interesting and dramatic about this and explore some real issues. And instead, she just sort of devolves and gets more wolf-like. And everyone's just like, oh, we really like her now. And at one point, she like goes into her boss's office and has sex with him. And then he leaves. And then she poops on his desk and sets it on fire. It's just like, what?
And we've all wanted to do that.
Who hasn't? And it's kind of interesting. And I was with it for a while. But I just feel like by the end, you need to come to some sort of conclusion.
Sure.
And the conclusion probably shouldn't just be, yeah, she probably shouldn't have picked up that wolf. Like, you need more than that. Like, and I'm not sure the movie did, or if it did, I think it went in a very trite sort of direction. And I just feel like it's such a bag of worms to open.
I mean,
you really have to look at each worm.
Is the wolf sort of a metaphorical kind of, you know, her self-empowerment or...
Not really, because the wolf is still very much other. She doesn't, like, become the wolf.
Mm.
She doesn't become... She becomes kind of wolf-ish. But the wolf is something that she wants to, with herself.
Huh.
There's a part where she refers to the person she's... Someone asks if she's sleeping with anybody, and what they mean is anything. And she says, yeah, what does he do? Oh, just sort of sits around and looks good. Like, that's all I want. And so it's just basically like her eschewing the everyday nonsense that isn't doing anything for her, that she's not getting out of. And you could have totally told this story and just had her, just have it be like Walden or something.
Mm.
And instead we went the wolf sex bit. And I feel like wolf sex and bestiality and all of those things should be explored as their own entity and not just as a metaphor for, isn't modern living kind of lame? And I'm like, yes. Yes, it is. Not sure we needed this movie.
Do we have to go here specifically?
Yeah, and if you're going to go here, go there. That's my point.
Sure,
like, seriously, embrace it, figure out what it is, and I just don't feel like they came to enough of a conclusion about something that no one's making movies about.
Sure.
This could have been a really daring, interesting film, and instead I just thought it didn't go anywhere, and it's frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
It's frustrating.
We also both saw Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship.
Oh, yeah.
Based on the Jane Austen short story Lady Susan.
Yes.
When I reviewed it for the wrap, I said that in the way that that Fantastic Mr. Fox sort of revealed that Wes Anderson was just sort of making, you know, stop motion animated films all along.
He's just been doing dioramas this whole time.
Just
for
human beings.
Yeah.
That really Whit Stillman has been Jane Austen all this time.
Kinda,
like,
yeah.
All the sort of like people constrained by these, you know, societal mores, these kind of romantic game playing, the witty banter.
And not just witty banter from people who don't know they're not witty. If you look at Metropolitan and Barcelona in particular, I think you look at a lot of people, or damsels in distress, these are people who are talking out of their butts the whole time.
Right.
And they think like, oh no, I've got everything figured out. And then they say the dumbest thing you've ever heard. But it sounds kind of good.
Sure, yeah,
if
yeah.
you weren't paying attention, you might think that they had their life together.
And he does the thing here that I always kind of, that I get a kick out of his movies, where certain phrases or sentences get repeated a lot. Mm. Like in Damsels in Distress, there's that one character who keeps talking about, I think of the playboy or operator type.
Yes. You know? And here it's like, well, they talk about this one really dumb character, and
he's no King Solomon.
Yeah, he's no Solomon, but, and that just sort of catches on, and people say.
And there's a thing that there's also the Kate Beckinsale's character, who is this widow who's trying to marry her daughter off to this rich dolt, talks about this woman who is sort of traveling with her as her servant. It's like, well, as we're both friends, even the discussion of payment would embarrass us both.
Yes. Kay Beckinsale plays a really unusual character, and I love her character, even though I hate her character.
Yeah.
She's just this incredible... She reminded me of... This might be a deep cut. If anyone listening has seen the TV show Prophet, which lasted for one season, and became kind of legendary because it was really one of the great anti-heroes. He was basically a villain, and his whole thing was, I want to become vice president of acquisitions at this big corporation, and then he will destroy anyone in his path. He will manipulate anybody. There's nothing he wouldn't do or say, and yet he comes across off smelling like a rose. And that's kind of this woman. She wants to marry off her daughter, maybe herself someday, and she wants to protect her image at all costs, even though she's sleeping around.
She's kind of Scarlett O'Hara in a way, without touching dirt.
Yeah, a little bit,
but she's very driven. She's ambitious, but also very charming. Like, she's this kind of infamous flirt. And so, you know, she's just a very good sort of manipulator, and she's always sort of spinning these webs. And it's I had forgotten how appealing Kate Beckinsale could be.
Right? Because, hasn't it been forever?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen her so long just doing those stupid catsuit vampire movies.
Kate Beckinsale is one of the many actors, who I think is too pretty for their own good, because studios want to keep putting them into generic hero roles.
Right.
Or you know, like, be an underworld, be in Whiteout. Anything, but they're actually a better character actor, and once you give her something to work with, she's like, Colin Farrell is my go-to example of this. You put him in Bruges or even Fright Night, and he's great. Well, you put him in The Recruit, he doesn't know what to do.
Well, I mean, Charlize Theron, after all the mighty Joe Youngs in the world, like, alright, I'm just gonna make my own movie, and I'm gonna put on weight, and I'm gonna look like a horror, and, you know, and she won an Oscar. And that's the thing, that you're right, I think if you're too pretty, you don't get taken seriously, you don't get considered for these sort of meaty roles, so Beckinsale and Chloe Sevigny, who both starred in Stillman's Last Days of Disco, are in this. Sevigny has a smaller role, but she's a lot of fun to watch, too. Really great cast. Xavier Samuel, who was in Fury, and I think one of the Twilight movies, plays this guy who initially is very disapproving of Beckinsale's character, but so she goes out of her way to like charm offensive him into submission. And this guy, Tom Bennett, a British actor I have never heard of before.
Oh my lord, is he funny.
He is a genius. He steals every moment that he's on screen. Even if he's not talking, he just has this look on his face that you just keep watching him to see what he's going to do next. He plays this...
The dolt.
A bit of a rattle, as Austin describes him. And they do the sort of that sort of society, you know, line dancing, and he's flailing his arms around and clapping real loud.
He just skips.
Smiling like a
goofball.
He
should be the annoying comic relief character who doesn't feel like he's in the right movie. Instead, he's great. Like, he's just real. And the interesting thing about this movie is, for the first, like, 20 minutes or so, I wasn't sure if I was going to like it.
Well,
because it's a little dry.
And there's a million characters, and they're all introduced with these sort of... They're not freeze frames, but, like, the camera is sort of just stock still on them, and there's this kind of iris around them, and their name and a little description.
It's like a silent movie.
Yeah. It actually says dramatis personae.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them, because it's, you know, for a short story, there's like a dozen major characters.
Well, and actually, I interviewed with Stillman, and it won't be up on Crave Online by the time this episode goes out, but it should be up in the next day or two.
Okay.
But I interviewed him about, like, sort of the adaptation process, and that character, I think Sir Martin, the dolt.
Sir John Martin.
Apparently barely mentioned in the book. He's not a major character in the book. He's only a little bit silly, and like the majority of the stuff he does was actually with Stillman.
Oh.
And he has some of the funniest lines. He gets this bit about the 12 commandments. He's just like, oh, that's the 12 commandments. Well, of course, God sent down the 12 commandments. Oh, and we have to follow them all. Don't you mean 10? Oh, we only have to follow 10? Oh, which two should we not follow? Oh.
Yeah, no, and this is Stillman's first adaptation. Like, all of his films up till now have been originals. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it very much feels like, you know, it's so of a piece with his stuff, and of a piece with the other sort of the best of the Austin movies at the same time.
Yeah, it's interesting because the other thing I asked him was why Lady Susan? Because no one knows about it, where the other one's taken.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just like, well, if I do Lady Susan, I'm not necessarily being held up against Sense and Sensibility or Pride and Prejudice and all these other big famous ones, and I can kind of mix it up a bit and make it my own. And it really does, it feels exactly like a Whit Stillman movie, feels exactly like a Jane Austen movie, feels a little digital, it feels like a bit of a BBC adaptation, like it looks a little too sharp for me.
I liked the lighting of it, it was mostly sort of sunlight through windows in a way, or candlelight. And so it kind of gave it felt legitimately period, but at the same time a sort of lived-in period, and not just this like kind of, you know, it's a museum, but we're going to step over the rope and sit on the settee.
It grew on me. It's just for a little bit, it felt more like an episode of Downton Abbey, and not like not necessarily like the really fancy ones like early on, when
right.
they sold less money. And
it's a Dutch cinematographer who I don't think really has any big credits yet in the U.S.
So like I said, it took a little bit for me to figure out who everyone was, exactly what's going on, because it's all in dialogue, and it's all about characters who aren't necessarily in the room.
Right.
But once I settled in and I got into the tone of the movie, it's really, really funny, and I would recommend it. It's not probably my least favorite Whit Stillman movie, but that's still really good. I love Whit Stillman movies.
I've never sat and ranked those, so I don't know. Yeah. I would have to watch Barcelona again.
I'd have to watch Last Days of Disco again. I only saw that once right when it came out. My memory is a little hazy, but I love Barcelona. I love Metropolitan. I love Damsels in Distress.
Mm.
Haven't seen his Amazon show, which I had to admit to his face, it was a little embarrassing.
I never made it past the pilot, so I don't think anybody else watched it either.
Yeah, well, apparently he's working on more. He's just hasn't been official yet. So anyway, let me see what else.
Yeah, you're
on.
Way ahead of
me. I saw 11 just, like, freaking movies. Let me see what I got here. Hang on, I have a whole list. Belgica. This was the first film playing at Sundance. Sundance has this weird history, apparently, of not showing their best films in their opening nights. Mm.
A lot of festivals, actually. Like, Cannes is infamous for the opening night film being a dud. Like, the Grace of Monaco was an opening night film at Cannes.
And I remember, like, I was in the theater waiting to see Whiplash, which was an open night movie. Mm. And everyone was like, oh, this is going to suck. It's a Sundance opening night movie. And we watched it. I'm like, holy, that movie was great. And we were like, oh, maybe the tide has shifted. And then last year it was The Bronze, which is terrible. And it's finally coming out. And I'm going to rewatch it just in case maybe they edited out some of the real unpleasantness. But man, did that movie not work. And this year it was Other People, which was pretty good, and Belgica.
Well, and that Norman Lear doc, which everybody said was too fawning.
I didn't see it. But I did see Belgica. Belgica is the new film from a guy whose name I can't pronounce terribly well.
The Belgian filmmaker behind the
Broken Circle Breakdown.
Broken Circle Breakdown.
A Broken Circle Breakdown, which you didn't like, but I actually liked a lot.
Yeah, I didn't find it appealing.
I thought he had a really excellent way of taking a very excellent soundtrack and using it to tell a very straightforward melodrama, but did it in a way that was very human and personal. And Belgica is very much the same way. It's about two brothers, who one of whom has a wife and child and is starting to feel a little listless. And another one who is younger and kind of a go-getter, and he's just somehow, like, they don't even go into it, he somehow has a bar now. So, okay, well, so kind
of... In Belgium, they just give you one.
I guess. And so the brother with a wife, Frank, goes to his younger brother, Joe, and she says, hey, can I work in your bar? And it turns out they're a pretty good team, and then the bar starts expanding, and then it becomes a nightclub, and the nightclub becomes really hip. Like, it's really, really cool. The music in this movie is astounding. Like, it's... I want the soundtrack right now, and I want to listen to it on repeat for, like, a day. It's that good.
Huh.
The drama is lame. That's the problem. It can't elevate it, because the drama is so familiar. It's like, oh, we've got a club. Well, one of the brothers is going to do a lot of drugs, right? Yeah, oh, he's going to do a lot of drugs. Okay. Mm-hmm. You going to do anything interesting with that? Yeah, an alcoholic dad off camera? Never going to see that trauma? Never see how it influences their lives? Okay. So what we've really got here is like a whole bunch of B-roll footage of you know, this amazing venue, and like a lame melodrama kind of tacked onto it. But the venue itself, you feel like you're there. It's a really great sense of place.
That was my problem with Broken Circle Breakdown. It was half this sort of Mumford and Sons light by Belgian people music being performed, and then like this cancer kid storyline. I was like, I'm not really interested in either.
I thought they worked better together, and I thought, I don't know, I thought they just weaved in more naturally. There's like a first 45 minutes of this movie where I'm just like, where's like, when's it gonna pick up? Like, when's it gonna like grab me and do something? And it's, he's trying to like, I think he's trying to play it real chill and like, you know, just sort of let the drama wash over you. But it's never sufficiently dramatic enough to propel it forward. And I ended up feeling like this movie's designated driver. Like, this movie's just gonna get real boozy and like have a really great time. And I'm gonna be sitting at a bar drinking a club soda, waiting for it to cheat on its wife, and then I can leave. Like that's it. Like, the whole thing, it's, people are just gonna ruin their lives. And it's just like, I felt like, and this is both a compliment and an insult, I felt like I was in that club.
Mm.
And I got tired of it real fast. And I would have left after about like half an hour. I'm like, oh, that band's really great, but it's too loud. Everyone's real abrasive. They're doing too many drugs. I'm uncomfortable. I can't do the drugs, so I'm just going to go. And instead, I have to sit there and watch these brothers fight.
I can't leave until the lights come on.
Exactly. So I don't hate it. It's not made incompetently. It just, it wasn't very good.
Gotcha.
Let's see. Let's do another one. Hunt for the Wilder People. Oh, I love this movie. Okay, so Hunt for the Wilder People is the latest film from Taika Waititi, who did Eagle vs. Shark and he did Boy, and most recently he did What We Do in the Shadows, which is great.
Yes.
Yeah. He's back with a new film.
And is he directly involved with Flight of the Conchords at all?
He directed some episodes.
Okay. Because I know that he, did he co-direct or co-write Shadows?
He co-wrote, Jermaine? And I think he might have co-directed it with Jermaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords, but this one's all him. Okay. And he's adapting it from a New Zealand novel with which I'm unfamiliar. And it is the story of this little, like, 11, 12-year-old pudgy foster kid who thinks he's all gangster. And he's not, but he's just annoying enough that every foster family has gotten rid of him. And they keep listening, like, oh yeah, no, he's... They list off this whole list of offenses, like shoplifting, and they really make a big thing about loitering. Oh, he'll loiter with the best of them. Like, holy cow. It's basically the last family in New Zealand.
Mm.
It's this wonderful lady who's very outgoing and very cheerful. And it's just like, oh, you want some food? You obviously like food, don't you? And she rubs his head and he just can't help but love her. And then Sam Neill plays her like, she wanted the kid husband. And he's just this hunter and he's kind of gruff. And will he like the boy? Won't he like the boy? And it turns out the kid actually starts feeling really, really at home. And just when he starts kind of feeling like things are normal and he feels loved and maybe life is going to be okay, she dies. Just freak. They don't even say, just heart attack or something. Just dies. Happens early on. It's not a spoiler. And then it turns out that, you know, the situation has changed. He may not be able to stay with Uncle Heck, played by Sam Neill.
Mm-hmm.
And so the kid tries to run away. And so Uncle Heck runs off into the bush to find him. And then he, like, breaks his ankle or something, and they're far enough away that all they can really do is camp out until he's healthy enough to walk out.
Mm.
By the time they walk out, they're public enemy number one. He has kidnapped that child. Everyone thinks he's a child molester.
Oh, God.
And so the kid's going to end up going to juvie. He's going to end up going to jail. So they're both like, screw it, let's just go back into the bush. And so they're just off on their own having this weird Badlands adventure and there's like SWAT teams flooding into the forest to try to catch them. And it just starts escalating more and more and more in somewhat ludicrous ways. By the end, there's like a car chase and it feels like The Legend of Billie Jean.
I was going to say, or the Sugarland Express.
A little bit, yeah. So, and it's wonderful. Like, the cast is great. There's got like real adventure to it. It's really, really, really funny. It feels like the kind of kids movies, not family movies, not movies you have to watch with your parents. Kids movies they used to make in the 1980s, where all they really had to do was be reasonably well made and appeal to kids and make it seem like something you might want to do and maybe show you why you shouldn't do that. So this feels like of a piece with like Monster Squad or Frog Dreaming or Goonies or something like that. They're all, you know, a little naughty, but ultimately got a really, really good heart, and they're told really, really, really well. And I highly recommend this. I know it's going to come out soon. It has to, because it's great. Really, best movie I've seen at Sundance since Whiplash.
Wow, okay.
Certainly most entertaining. Well, okay, actually, maybe not, because the second movie, the other best movie I saw along here is Manchester by the Sea, and it's awesome.
Well, you've segued. Well, tell us what now.
I'm sorry, okay.
You've seen like three times.
I know, I feel bad. So, Next one's yours, whatever it is. Manchester by the Sea is the new film from Kenneth Lonergan,
yes.
Who did You Can Count on Me, a movie I respect but don't necessarily like that much. And he did Margaret, a movie I love and you don't particularly care for.
Well, I'm holding final judgment until I see the director's cut, but the theatrical version infuriated.
He does these very just humanistic dramas about people who have like one interesting incident that happens to them, mm-hmm. and then just how they deal with it. And then life also goes on and they have to deal with that too.
Right.
That's basically it. It's not necessarily wham, bam, put it on the poster filmmaking.
Yeah.
But he's got a really, really great way with subtle dialogue that feels completely natural, yet speaks volumes and is funny.
He's a very playwrighty director.
He is a very playwrighty director, but it works, and he's getting more interesting and cinematic. This film stars Casey Affleck giving maybe his best performance. He's so good in this movie. As the brother of Kyle Chandler. Kyle Chandler has like a heart defect, and they know he only has so long to go. They're kind of ready for that call, and he gets the call. His brother has died. It's horrible. He goes back to Manchester, where he has a past. They're
New England or
New England.
Okay,
yeah. Sorry, New England. Yes, he goes back to Manchester where he has a past, and that's a bit of a mystery. I won't tell you what happens, but it's just like there's a reason why he doesn't come back. Mm. And now he has to take care of his teenage son. And your first thought when you hear that...
Wait, you have to take care of Kyle Chandler's
son. Yes.
Okay.
Your first thought when you hear that is, oh, it's going to be one of those Sundance movies. We're all going to learn a valuable lesson in lip-syncing to toothbrushes. And it's not. And it's actually just one of the best films I've seen about coping with a death. And just the way that life goes on, you still have to eat. You still lose your car in the parking lot. You have to make all the phone calls. And it's not boring. It's actually riveting. Just because every character is so richly defined and you always know their attitude about everything. And the teenage son is an amazing character. Like, he's really just unexpected. And I don't want to ruin it. Not that it's a big twist or anything like that. But just discovering how interesting and unusual his social life is. It's just such a fun experience. It's great. The performances are amazing. Michelle Williams has a small role, but God, she steals it.
Mm.
And it's a movie that I don't know if you're going to want to run out and wait in line. And go, we got to see Manchester by the Sea. Yeah! But when it comes out, see this movie and just appreciate what a great drama it is without like a huge setup or hook or high concept. It's just life is dramatic and it's really interesting and Casey Affleck is great.
Hmm. Well, you've given me a segue. Yay! A movie that I really loved, which, admittedly, I put it in the category of I gotta see this again at sea level to be absolutely double positive sure that I love it.
Okay.
But at the moment, I love it. It's a film called Captain Fantastic. It's written and directed by Matt Ross, who did a movie called 28 Hotel Rooms. I mainly know him as an actor. He was on Big Love, and he's in The Last Days of Disco.
Ooh.
And it stars Viggo Mortensen, and he lives out in the woods in the Pacific Northwest with six children. The oldest one is like 17, 18. The youngest is, I think, six. And, you know, we first see them sort of collectively stalking and killing a deer. And they have this whole sort of like, you know, camp in the middle of the forest, you know. Sort of like, it looks like sort of a survivalist compound or something. They grow their own food. They, you know, skin the deer and they, you know, like...
It's like Mosquito Coast, but it went well.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. You know, and then, but, you know, so, like, they're constantly doing these sort of training exercises where they're, like, rock climbing and, you know, doing all this physical stuff, but at the same time, like, you know, at night, they're sitting around the fire, and one kid's reading the Brothers Karamazov, and another one is reading Middlemarch, and somebody else is reading, like, you know, Quantum Theory, and they talk about this stuff, and he makes them, like, you know, explain things and discourse about it.
Is it like The Village? Do they know there's an outside world?
Yes.
Okay.
So, the mother of all these folks, you know, is sort of, she's away, she's not well. Turns out she is bipolar and has killed herself.
Ah.
So the family finds this out, they're devastated, and her parents basically tell Viggo Mortensen that, you know, like, don't come to the funeral, we don't want you there, we'll have you arrested if you show up, you know.
Yeah.
And but he decides, you know what, screw it, like, the kids all want to go, they really want to see their mother off. And in fact, her last will, she was a Buddhist and she wanted to be cremated and the parents were going to bury her. So they hop into this bus that they have and they drive to New Mexico.
It's Little Miss Sunshine.
It all of this, I know, sounds like bits of other Sundance movies and it sounds too precious for words. But it's... I really loved it. I mean, I loved how eccentric this family was. It reminded me in ways of my own family, the way that my father would, like, ask us questions about history or science or whatever and make us talk about it on car trips or at the dinner table or whatever. Sure. And, you know, there are moments where it almost feels like it's going to get really smug about, like, how well-educated Viggo Mortensen's kids are, even though they've been living off the grid, but... You know, you come to find out that they're completely at sea in the modern world. And not just that, but they don't know how to relate to other people. Like,
yeah.
The oldest son, who's played by, I think George MacKay is his name, he was the lead in this British movie called Pride. You know, they're in a trailer park, and he, like, this girl flirts with him, and they kiss. And at the end of the evening, he proposes marriage to her. And she and her mother played with Missy Pyle, like, oh, that's hilarious. You know, and he has no idea. He doesn't, like, these kids just don't know how to, like, interact with the rest of the world. So it's, you know, it's about sort of finding this middle ground, and it's about grief, and it's about a lot of stuff. And I laughed a lot. I wept for the last 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I really, really like this movie.
We've talked a bit about how several films feel like they're cobbled together from other Sundance movies, and I want someone to make, like, on Facebook, like, one of those memes where it's the automatic Sundance movie generator.
Oh, right.
And it randomizes, like, is it gay teen or single mom? Okay, single mom runs away from society and blank. I don't know. Yeah, and there's a musical number.
Opens a strip joint.
Yeah, exactly. Just like, ah, and you... No, someone would buy it.
Yeah, a feminist collective strip joint.
How many do you have left?
I have a couple, so, you know.
Okay. Well, I just want to make sure it's all.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
No, it's fine.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, fine. Okay, well, let's mix it up a bit, because I saw Rob Zombie's new film, 31.
Ooh.
Okay, so Rob Zombie, as a musician, he's Rob Zombie. Yeah. I like Rob Zombie. He's a good musician, and, you know, he makes that kind of... heavy metal that you mostly just want to drive to, you know, that kind of thing. Like, and that's fine. It's good stuff. And
what about Rob Zombie filmmaker?
Rob Zombie filmmaker is really divisive, isn't he?
Yeah.
A lot of people really, really like his stuff. A lot of people really hate his stuff. And as is often the case with really divisive filmmakers, I'm in the middle. I like some of them and I don't like others.
I was going to say, I like the idea of him, and I haven't seen all of his films, but the stuff that I know that I've seen from, say... Night of a Thousand or House of a Thousand Corpses, or
right?
I dig and I see what he's trying to do. I hated the two Halloween movies.
I will say I'm gonna just give everyone like a real quick recap because I find a lot of Rob Zombie fans are interested in where opinions on Rob Zombie films come from.
Uh-huh.
Just so you know, I say coming from a hater or whatever. So real quick, House of a Thousand Corpses, a huge mess, but he was learning. Okay, Devil's Rejects. Vile but excellent, like a really sick, twisted, wonderful grindhouse movie. Halloween, huge mistake, weird idea. I guess I give him credit for not just remaking it, but it didn't work. Halloween 2, kind of brilliant, actually.
Ugh.
Taking all the ideas, like the random, like, handful of ideas from Halloween 2, 4, 5, and 6 that in a vacuum were actually pretty good and made, like, the one Halloween sequel. And I'm like, okay, that's actually kind of interesting. I kind of like that movie, or at least I admire its audacity.
Okay, I didn't know the sequels well enough to get all of that.
Yeah, it's like everything. Like, from the fact that Loomis wrote a book, that's from Halloween 6. The psychic relative, that's from Halloween 5. The idea that a relative is going to go evil at the end, that's from Halloween 4. Like, it's all all of these lame sequels. Actually, 4 is okay. But all of the lame sequels, he took a couple of good things that worked, made a movie out of it. Interesting idea. I think it's an interesting experiment. Lords of Salem, I think is awesome. I think it's a really, really good film. And I might be forgetting one, but okay. And then he did 31. 31 is The Running Man, but with clowns.
Explain, please.
Okay, so there's a group of, like, traveling entertainers. You get the impression that they're carnies, but you never see the carnival, so I'm not sure what exactly they were doing. And it's made of people like Meg Foster, who's awesome, and a couple of actors and regulars who are often in his movies, and Sherry Moon Zombie, because she's in everything he does.
Of course. Oh, and what's his face?
Whose name I never remember.
Spider-Baby guy, you know.
Yeah, oh, no, Sinéad isn't it.
Oh, okay.
For once, Sid Haig isn't in a Rob Zombie movie. It's weird. So they're all on the road, and it's actually kind of interesting because it's a horror movie about everyone in their 40s. There's no teenagers. Any other filmmaker, this movie would be about teenagers. Here, all people in their 40s, they pull over and have like this Texas Chainsaw moment with weird people at a gas station. Then in the middle of the night, there's a roadblock. They get out. They get kidnapped.
Huh.
They wake up in basically like the royal palace from Cheech and Chong's The Corsican Brothers, and Malcolm McDowell is there in like a pompadour wig and white face and like one freckle that indicates his sexuality or something. If you look, there's like a reason why the freckles are on different parts of your face. I should look it up. And he says, "Welcome to 31, a game show they run like every Halloween, where a bunch of random people are put in like this weird, like sort of crazy haunted house type dilapidated factory that's been like renovated and has disgusting graffiti everywhere. And they have to fight off homicidal clowns for 12 hours. If they win, they don't die.
This sounds vaguely like Nothing But Trouble.
It's like it's got Nothing But Trouble in there, but really it's every The Most Dangerous Game you've ever seen. The Most Dangerous Game, Hard Target, Running Man, Surviving the Game. And now it's with Killer Clowns. One of whom is played by E.G. Daly, which is weird.
Ooh.
She's actually great.
Okay.
This movie is basically, you hear Rob Zombie's doing The Running Man, but all the bad guys are clowns. The movie you have in your head right now, that's this movie. It's exactly what you think it's going to be. And it's, if you're a fan of Rob Zombie movies, I think you're going to like it. It's violent. It's kind of inventive, even though it's kind of just Rob Zombie putting his stamp on a familiar trope. Mm. It's well shot. As always, I think Sherry Moon Zombie is a really, really great presence. I think she's a really, really solid lead actress, and I wish she'd do other people's films more often, because I want to see her more. So she's
awesome.
When
we get the generation of filmmakers who were inspired by Rob Zombie, they will cast her.
I interviewed her, and she said, "I turn a lot of people down. I actually don't like acting that much." So I think she only does it because Rob does it. Which is just a shame, because she's really, really good in this movie. I should look up the actor's name. There's this really, really great actor. He played the guy who killed Bruce Wayne's parents in Batman Begins. He plays like the main clown, named Doomhead. And he's just great. He's just this great supervillain character. It's not great. I'm not gonna say everyone needs to rush out and see it, but if Rob Zombie's doing The Running Man with clowns appeals to you, see this movie. It's exactly what you want from it. It's not bad, it's just not great.
Okay.
What are you gonna do?
I saw Author, the J.T. Leroy story, which apparently has gotten picked up by somebody. Which I figured it would, because it's, you know, it's got Vice behind it and Brett Ratner's production company. And it's about the whole crazy J.T. Leroy story and about Laura Albert creating this fake, you know, sexually abused, HIV-positive teenage boy who's gender ambiguous, who starts writing the stories of his terrible life and how they got published and they became super popular, and she had to get her boyfriend's sister to start being J.T. Leroy in public, because Laura was doing it on the phone, but she had to have somebody to send out to events. And
it's the original Catfish.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's totally that. Now, last summer at Outfest, we screened a film called The Cult of J.T. Leroy, which I thought was really great and really an interesting look into the whole nutty story. Like, Google the story. It's bananas. And it was told by a filmmaker who I think at some point had access to Laura Albert and company, and then at some point kind of got like pushed out of it, but then still continued to follow the story and interviewed a lot of the other people involved. This one is Laura Albert doing kind of a first person confessing everything, explaining everything. But Laura Albert is famous for two things. One, writing the J.T. Leroy novels, and two, being the most unreliable narrator on earth.
Yeah.
You know,
you're famous for lying.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like the end of Mrs. Doubtfire. Like, I want to believe you love your family, but you convinced your own family that you were a 60-year-old woman. I can't trust the thing you say.
So it's almost like, but the movie never calls her on any of this stuff. This isn't like F for Fake or something where they actually are sort of exploring her. I mean, she discusses her own kind of pathology about her childhood and how crappy it was, and how she would sort of invent these other characters on the phone, or like how she got into punk, but she felt like she was a fat girl and she couldn't go to punk shows, so she would dress her sister up and send her out to, and like tell her what to say, and like had, like the sister became her avatar. So I mean, it's fascinating stuff, and like stuff that you don't get from Cult of J.T. Leroy, because you're getting it directly from Laura Albert. But at the same time, this movie has stuff that is in Cult of J.T. Leroy, because it's calling Laura Albert on her crap. And so it's one of those cases where I really think you need to see both movies together, because I think they each fill in the gaps of the other one. This is the one that more people are going to see, but I hope that Cult of J.P. LeRoy also gets out there, because I think that that combined, those two films really tell a more complete story.
Yeah.
But even if you just see this one, it's a fascinating story. And, you know, this one has all the phone conversations that she recorded. So, talking to Gus Van Sant, talking to, you know, all these celebrities, talking to Courtney Love, who says, "I hate to put you on hold, but I need to do this line of coke." I mean, she actually says that on the phone.
It's like, no, you understand. It's going to go bad.
Exactly. Yeah, it's bonkers. But anyway, we're totally worth seeing.
Right. I only got to see one documentary, and it's Lo and Behold, Reveries of the Connected World. It's the new Werner Herzog documentary about the internet.
Okay.
In its entirety. It's like, it's a weird concept. And he's basically, he's interested in the internet, obviously, in the last 20 years, and it really only goes back about 50.
Sure.
Right back to its birth. The world has completely changed. Like, it's in a way that it hadn't before. Like,
yes, it has.
Yeah, like, ever since, you know, the book was invented, like, that's the biggest change. And he tries to tackle it. It's like 10 different chapters. Mm-hmm. Each one tackles it from a different angle. First, it's just the history of it. Where did it come from? How did it get coded?
What does he say about cat videos?
He doesn't actually say anything about cat videos. I was surprised. At one point, he talks about online harassment and how it's sort of the anonymity gives people carte blanche to explore their evil natures.
Sure.
Talks about people who become addicted to the internet. He doesn't specifically call out porn. He does focus a little bit on video games. But just people who can't function in real world anymore because they're so busy being connected.
Well, remember Second Life?
Oh, yeah.
That whole thing?
No one cared about it. But Second Life was not a big deal. Like, Warcraft and The Sims
were way more. Yeah, no, Second Life turned into the MySpace of, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, it was a thing.
Yeah, people absolutely.
People lived their lives that way.
And there's other things as well. He talks about, like, you know, every few centuries there's usually one giant solar flare that actually will fry all the electronics on the planet.
Hmm.
We're doomed. Like, there are, like, things that run on the internet so much that they're like, no one will be able to get, like, food in Los Angeles. Like, no, they won't know to ship things out. Like, there's no system in place. Nothing's backed up. There was a guy talking about how the history of the internet will actually be lost because the internet got developed so fast and no one thought to save anything on it. Like, the emails and everything like that. So there's going to be, like, this dark age of the internet in which nothing was curated.
Well, it's like how, you know, no one's photos are going to exist if all that stuff goes away. I mean, Dave and I have talked about this before. We've written for websites that no longer exist, and you can't find those articles anywhere.
So,
this is all in the last, you know, I mean, that specific example in the last 10 years. But yeah, I've been online for 20 years.
This is why, like, I know digital books are convenient and everything. Buy the book. You will have the book.
Yeah.
No matter what happens, like, you're basically paying to rent stuff from Amazon, even if you buy it. You know, like,
they can pull it back whenever they feel like.
Exactly. So you have to be really, really careful about that. I know there's ways around that, but still, it's better to have hard copies of some of these things. So he talks about that, and he talks about all kinds of stuff, and it's an interesting film to watch, and a lot of the issues he raises are intriguing. As with any time Werner Herzog makes a documentary about an inanimate thing, he asks if it dreams. He did that for that Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Like, but do they dream? And everyone's just...
Does the cave dream?
Does the internet dream? And everyone's like, I don't know, what? Yeah, sure, Werner, whatever you say. it's interesting, and I kind of wish that once all was said and done, he came to some sort of conclusion. Not that he figured out the internet. Not that he decided what we should all think about it. But that there was a particular reason given for why he focused on the things he focused on and didn't focus on the things he didn't focus on.
Right.
And they just sort of just came to the end. And even just said, like, think about that. Instead of just sort of like, huh, okay. So,
well, that's interesting.
In some respects, the world is better. In some respects, the world is worse. And life will go on, is basically what you said. I wish you'd come to more of a conclusion than that, but it's still really interesting, and there's a lot of fascinating characters involved, and you should see it.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
The most recent thing that I saw, I've got a couple more screenings coming up in the next few days.
Same here.
Skedaddle, is Spa Night, the first feature film from an LA-based filmmaker named Andrew Ahn. I can't really review this movie because I know Andrew from Outfest. We screened his short film, Doll First Birthday. And I suspect we'll probably be screening this one. I hope we are. But it's beautifully made. It has a really strong sense of place. It's set almost entirely, I think, or if not entirely, in Koreatown in Los Angeles. And it's about a young guy who he's in his early 20s. His friends have all gone off to college. He's been working at his parents' restaurant to help them out. And they lose the restaurant, and these sort of other kind of family tensions come bubbling up to the surface. And as we come to realize, he is super deeply closeted gay guy.
Okay.
And finds a certain sense of being able to kind of, to some extent or other, follow that aspect of himself by getting a job in a Korean spa. Which are, you know, as a friend of mine who goes to them says, some of them are no shenanigans zones, and some of them are some shenanigans zones. And so witnessing the shenanigans, you know, is sort of like the closest he has is kind of a sexual outlet.
Good enough.
And it's sort of, you know, but the other tensions in his life build up. And it's a very slow-paced film, and it's very internalized about his. He's very shy and quiet, and so it's not like he's got these big monologues to explain things. And, you know, he's very reactive, but the lead actor, whose name I don't know, is really great and really, like, you know, strikingly, relatably handsome, you know, not like model handsome, but just like a good-looking guy. So, like, you know, knows how to hold a close-up and knows how to convey a lot without getting much dialogue. So it'll be interesting how that plays. It's not ever explicitly sexual, but there is a lot of male nudity because it's set in a in a bathhouse.
That would happen.
So, weird
if there wasn't.
Exactly. So I don't know if there are certain distributors that are going to be freaked out about it, or if it's going to deal with the MPAA or blah blah blah. But it's a cool movie. I think people should check it out.
All right, and the last one I've seen already, and like you, I've got a couple more before I leave. I leave before you do, but I'm going to try to fit in Kevin Smith's Yoga Hosers and the Barack Obama movie South Side by the Sea about his first date with Michelle and Christine. Not the car movie. So the last thing I saw is the new film from Anne Fontaine, who actually directed the first movie I ever saw at Sundance. Back then it was called Two Mothers. Later it was called Door.
Oh my God. Were you at that first screening?
That was the first Sundance screening I ever went to. It is a movie about Two mothers, played by Robin Wright and Naomi Watts, and they both have full-grown hunky sons, and they decide to switch and have them as lovers. Ugh. So my best friend's son is my lover, and my son is her lover. And there's something just, like, so European about that concept. And
it's based on a short story by Doris Lessing, of all people, that it got hooted at. I mean, people laugh at that movie.
It really does play like a comedy, or satire.
I can't remember if it was before or after Mother Lover. Remember the...
Oh, it was after.
The follow-up.
Oh, it was after.
Okay.
It was after.
Yeah.
So I
always remember the director getting like, I did not know I had made that comedy.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So it was really very odd. I don't hate it, but just, wow, was it a misfire? And I haven't seen any other movies, so I was very curious to see what she had for me this time, and this one's great.
This
is a great, serious drama and it's the Nazi movie. Actually, no, it's more the post-Nazi movie. It's right after World War II, and it's in Poland. Agata Kuleska from Ida.
Oh, okay, yeah.
She plays the Mother Superior at a nunnery in Poland, and a lot of the nuns are pregnant because at the end of the war, the Russian soldiers came in and raped everyone. Everyone. And this is destroying their faith. This is the secret. They can't let anyone know. And there's something wrong with one of the pregnant women. And so they have to, one of the nuns goes AWOL and actually brings in a doctor. She wasn't supposed to do that. They would rather die of shame, literally, than bring in a doctor. But she does it anyway. And this doctor ends up kind of without really, she helps because she's a doctor. She tries to help more, and then she starts getting more and more involved. She can't not help. She has to do something.
She's a female doctor.
Female doctor. Okay. And these are nuns whose vow of celibacy goes so far that they can't be touched. Like, so what am I supposed to do? But they end up coming to some sort of understanding, and more soldiers show up. It gets really suspenseful. And there's a couple of twists in there that I didn't see coming that were really, really great. And it feels like best foreign language film Oscar bait, but it's also really good. Like, it was really suspenseful. The acting is fantastic, especially from She, whose name I cannot pronounce, yes. but was awesome in Ida.
So this is this in Polish, or?
A lot of it is, yeah. Although I think the heroine is French, so she has a lot of the scenes in French.
Gotcha.
Yeah, just a very serious drama. But I was this isn't usually my favorite genre, you know, this sort of World War II depressing drama. But I was impressed by how completely swept up I was in it, and I would definitely recommend it to people. I think it's not just a World War II movie. It's also just a suspense movie. It's a very thoughtful movie, and it's great. Cool. So that's a good one, and not a people are talking about it yet. So,
no, somebody today was telling me that I really needed to see the Pregnant Nun movie. I didn't even mention the title. Now I know.
It's Agnes Day, although the original title is actually Les Innocents. Right. The Innocents.
Yes.
Which I think is a better title, but okay.
It's been taken.
Lee Daniels, The Innocents. Everything's been taken. They're doing it, man. No one cares.
All right. Well, so yeah, so it's been an interesting Sundance so far.
Yeah.
Hopefully, in the next couple of days, I'm seeing seeing Iris Axe's Little Men. I'm seeing this documentary for HBO called Suited about a tailor shop in Brooklyn that specializes in making... bespoke suits for butch lesbians, produced by Lena Dunham. So more cool stuff coming up. I actually have a DVD recommendation. I forgot to ask you beforehand.
Oh, okay. I can look up what's coming out like this next week or so. Okay. While you're doing that, I'll look
up. All right, because I've been meaning to, I've wanted to talk about this one for weeks, and just it's been weird episodes, and we haven't really been doing it. But coming out on Blu-ray for the very first time this month, it's already out, a movie that I love, and it was really it was hard to find on DVD for a very long time. I think it had a 2-second release, so I'm glad it's available now. And that would be Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Awesome movie.
Starring Tim Roth and Gary Oldman. And this is one of the few cases I know of somebody directing their own play. I mean, Mammoth has done it, I guess, and...
Yeah, and this was Tom Stoppard's first movie, too, so it was very odd.
Yeah.
And there was a good story he was telling about how he was on the set, and someone asked him, so are you going to need, like, the dolly and everything? It's like, oh, that's right, I can move the camera.
So it's a great adaptation of a wonderfully absurdist play about two minor characters in Hamlet, and who are... seemingly cognizant of the fact that they are in a drama and that it is someone else's drama. It's a great kind of, you know, head scratcher of a play, but it's also very funny. And Roth and Oldman just get the timing. Like it's like what it must have been like to see, I don't know, like Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen do Waiting for Godot. Like, these guys are just so steeped.
And they know the material. It's complex material.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's really funny. And honestly, it did change my perception of Hamlet in a good way. Like, I really, like, look at it, I'm like, oh, yeah. And I don't want to ruin how, if you haven't seen it. But it's really just the significance of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is sometimes overlooked.
Yes.
I think by a lot of people. They're the characters who lift out of the play quite easily if you're trying to trim it down.
Sure.
And this makes a very good case for why they're kind of the most important characters when you think about it. And it's really interesting.
Yeah, and it just sort of, to think in the larger sense of, like, you know, the people that we sort of, you know, whether it's in drama or in our own lives, the people who are sort of at the margins that we don't really think about, you know, have their own complex internal lives and, you know, their own goals and desires and whatnot. So, yeah, it's a movie I love, and I'm glad it's a lot more accessible now. So, yes, Rosencrantz going through it.
I'm going to pick two because they're basically recommending them for the same reasons.
Okay.
One came out, I think, this last week. Another one's coming out Tuesday. They are both films that are basically for kids that a lot of critics kind of, even if they like them, they overlook them or they just... And a lot of people just didn't see him out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both okay. They're both okay movies. One of them is Gem and the Holograms, which you and I are two of the only people who kind of dug it.
Yes.
If a lot of people really didn't give that movie a chance, and you can tell from looking at its box office numbers, it's not a very faithful adaptation of the show. That's because the show, I love the show, the show is stupid.
Yes.
The show is very, very silly. They decided, well, what if we took, like, the heart of the show, like, what the show's really about, and made something that's a little bit more contemporary and palatable, and everyone's like, no! We need motorcycles shaped like guitars! And without realizing that if they'd made that, no one but the Gem fans would have seen it.
Sure.
So I think they were just stuck. I don't think they were ever going to win. But it's a sweet movie. It's not a great movie, but it's perfectly charming.
It has several really good songs.
Decent. pop songs in it. I think it's got a lot of heart. It's got some real dumb stuff in it, too. Sure. I love John Chu. He directed one of my favorite movies, Step Up 3D, but drama is not his strong suit. He's good at performance. He's good at the sense of what it's like to perform and the joy of performance, and he sells that well, and everything else is kind
of
important.
And there are a couple of great scenes where Juliette Lewis and Molly Ringwald play off each other brilliantly.
They're so great.
I totally want to see a whole other movie just with them.
And the other one made more money, but it kind of disappeared off of everyone's radar after Halloween, and that's Goosebumps, which is actually a very good horror movie for young kids. Sure. And I think that's something that we mistake. We cater a lot of horror-themed movies to kids, mm-hmm. but there aren't enough scary movies that aren't so intense you'll give your kids nightmares for weeks, but the kids will actually have a good little thrill ride with it, and it'll be a gateway to bigger and more important horror later on. And the Goosebumps movie actually does a pretty good job. It's got good characters, good dialogue. The monsters are actually pretty scary. Mm-hmm. Like, the Wolfman's trying to kill him. No. Like, they're just trying to kill him, and they don't die.
Those garden gnomes are trying to kill him.
Yeah, and that there feels like there's real consequences, and it's something where normally you'd imagine this would be written down to, like, 8-year-olds. Instead, it's written up to, like, 15-year-olds, and it's a clever, fun movie, and if I were a kid, this would be one of my favorites.
There was I felt like we had a bumper crop a couple of years ago when, I think, like, Frankenweenie and Paranorman both came out.
Yeah, same year.
And they both seemed like, oh, yeah, these are movies that are genuinely scary on a kid level, mm-hmm. but that, you know, that aren't just sort of like wacky comedies with Dracula in them, you know.
And a lot of them get overlooked. Neither of those movies made a ton of money. Mm. And a lot of my favorite kids' movies and movies I've shown to kids and I've recommended to parents or their kids, and everyone afterwards are like, oh, we love it, bombed at the box office, and I don't know why. Earth to Echo is a great, charming movie with really wonderful kid actors and a good message about, like, the future generations and how technology will impact them.
That recent Winnie the Pooh movie that Dave and I are always recommending, that they opened opposite some juggernaut of I forget what, but it was yeah, it didn't
Real Steel is a fun movie. It's a dumb movie, but it's a fun movie. Everyone has that tone, and then you show it to a 10-year-old and they're like, this movie's great. Well, but no one was willing to take him to the theater because of that note you just hit.
I'm just saying, there are movies that I like that I think would also be great for a 10-year-old, and I thought that it was garbage, which is not to say that a 10-year-old wouldn't enjoy it, but 10-year-olds are 10-year-olds.
I like that movie more than a lot of people, but I find I like that movie more than a lot of people who haven't seen it. And yet have very distinct opinions. You saw it.
I saw it.
You have every right to your opinion. I know a lot of people who have a very firm opinion on that movie, and Gem and the Holograms, and Goosebumps, and Earth to Echo, and they haven't seen it.
Sure.
So, at the very least, I think these are movies that are worth a shot, and I think they're good for kids, and I think they're good for adults, too. If you have any access to your inner child, you'll like them.
Where do you fall on The Last Mimsy?
You know, I didn't see The Last Mimsy.
Me neither.
I don't think I was a professional film critic when The Last Mimsy came out, so I could just sort of like, I don't need to see The Last Mimsy. I don't need to see The Bridge to Terabithia.
Oh, Bridge to Terabithia is good.
I have heard the exact opposite from a lot of people.
No. Bridge to Terabithia is really good.
Okay.
And for a movie from Walden, which is like a fairly kind of Christian-y company... Yeah. There is an atheist child character in that movie who is not punished or judged for it.
Yes. Neat.
Yes. I'm telling you.
That's cool.
Walden is sort of stealth, not terrible a lot of times. I mean,
I like their Narnia movies.
The Narnia movies were fine. They did Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium, which I say is a grossly underrated movie. I really liked it.
I haven't seen it, but you've recommended it many times.
It's one of those movies that they did on the Flophouse, and I'm like, hey! You know,
that's how I felt about all of those anti-Gem movies. I was like, Takedown Pieces. I was like, really? Come on.
No,
it's not that bad.
Gem was
even if you don't like it, it's not that bad. It's not worse than a year bad. If you think that, if that's on your worst of the year list, you didn't see enough movies last
year.
Yeah,
I mean, like, it's not Bratz, for God's sake,
God,
you know?
No, like, oh, God, I wouldn't even come close.
All right, so it's always fun to have you on the Sundance Show, so thank you.
And again, if you miss Dave White, you can hear him on the B-Movies podcast, which is also on iTunes. You can follow our Twitter account at B-Movies Podcast, get a link to the episode there. And that's where they reviewed, whatever, they reviewed The Boy, The Fifth Wave,
right.
Dirty Grandpa,
yes,
which apparently is as bad as it sounds. And our new weekly segment, Shunting,
in
which we review the TV series Shadowhunters.
Yes.
Based on the Mortal Instruments, which is another movie I like that no one else did.
Yeah, see, Dave and I do a TV podcast, and we are not watching that show, because we both hated the Mortal Instruments with a passion. Now, if you can't get me into a movie with gay Brooklyn warlocks, you're doing it wrong. I'm sorry.
There is, in the first episode of Shadowhunters, there is a mythical biscotti. And there was a band called Champagne Enema. I'm in. I'm done.
I did give Dave a hard time because they talked about Chloe Grace Moretz in The Fifth Wave, and they said how she's a much better actress in this kind of crap material, and how Kristen Stewart needs to take her aside and, you know, get her in movies like Clouds of Silvermoria. I'm like, Chloe Grace Moretz was already in The Clouds of Silvermoria, you guys!
We can't leave them alone for a minute.
I know, but I totally get it now when you're listening to other people's podcasts and you're yelling at the speaker going, no, wrong, stupid!
It's just, and the thing is, I'm sure they probably realized it after the fact.
No doubt.
Whitney was probably writing it up, and it was like, oh, man, I'm an idiot.
No,
it happens to all of us, but now it's recorded.
Sure, yeah, no. Stuff flies out of my mouth all the time, or even when I'm thinking like the correct name and I say the wrong one because, you know.
The Dylan McDermott, Dermot Mulroney effect.
For instance.
Yeah,
exactly. Anyway, thank you as always for listening, you guys. I will be back in Los Angeles next week with Dave White, but in the meantime, check out our friends of the podcast universe, the B Movies podcast, of course.
Yay!
But also Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with Gray and Matt. I'm doing this without my piece of paper, so I'm going to be uhing it more than usual. The Joel Ryan Thing, Sewers of Paris, the Bret Easton Ellis podcast. Check out the Comics Canon with our good friend Kurt Holman. The Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion cast. Game Night Guys, Secretly Timid. The Schmoes Know, of course. Follow us on Facebook, like our Facebook page, leave us a review at iTunes where you can subscribe to the show for free. You can also stream us at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. I've been posting a bunch of pictures from different stuff at Sundance. And of course, drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We are launching our Patreon page in a week on January 31st. So we're very excited about that. We're going to have tons of subscription levels with lots of really fun premiums. For everybody who's been wanting to support the show, now is your opportunity, and we're thrilled to be able to bring you in on that. So, Bibbs, thanks again.
Thank you very much, good sir.
And we will catch you guys later.
Bye.
Goodbye.